Here are some genius tips from marketers who have built million-dollar brands. Let's jump into the first one. Yara Kamal, the owner of Score Your World, a seven-figure yoga brand. Let's jump into it.
It's been a roller coaster, and I know everyone gets it. Everyone finds Facebook ads very challenging. The first time I've started Facebook ads, I realized that maybe I didn't have a converting website and or converting products, and that's when my business was failing, and I was spending money on Facebook ads. And I had to realize and get honest with myself, knowing that my intuition was telling me these products weren't working or the website wasn't converting. So then throwing money into a website that isn't converting or products that won't convert can just be money thrown. And then I started realizing and understanding that, first of all, I got to get my website to be converting as much as I can and the products to be the products that people will have that wow reaction. And then when I did that, I kind of also wanted, so there's a few formulas, getting that website right, I learned all that slowly with time, experimenting, putting a lot of money. Getting that website right, getting those products right, and then getting the creative right. So if your creative doesn't work, if your creative is not understandable, quick, easy to grab, that was something I learned that won't work. So if the creative passes the whole like, exciting, quick, easy to read, can relate.
This podcast is brought to you by Marketer Hire. Marketer Hire is the leading network of pre-vetted freelance marketers matched to your business needs. So that includes freelance marketers for social media organic, pay social media, Google Ads, whatever you need, they have it. These are people trusted by Netflix, Allbirds, HelloFresh, Lyft. The list goes on and on. So if you're interested, hit the link below and sign up, and we're offering $500 off your starting package with Marketer Hire. So that's marketerhire.com. Hit the link below and sign up now. Tell them we sent you, and you will be getting $500 off your first retainer with your marketer. Now let's get back into the show.
You can relate to it. It can describe the benefits, the value of the product, all within a quick video that's engaging, then that's a creative that passes. So then you can work with, okay, that creative passes, and then now we can look into the website and because it has more clicks now. It took a while to kind of figure that out. I kind of free flowed with it. I didn't have any training with Facebook ads at all. I had a friend actually in the Fashion Zone, a shout out to Eddie. I had a friend who did give me that whole idea, like, you know, you need a video creative, just put that out. As long as your products work, they convert, put that creative. So I actually did that video myself very quickly, pulled up iMovie, tried to change whatever creatives I had, such as photos, other videos, filmed one of the videos myself. I was like, okay, let's like film this. I was determined to get something out. It didn't have to be a high budget. You don't have to film a video in high budget. You can literally, if it's clear, high quality, you can film it yourself. You can get someone like a friend to display a product. And it's actually more relatable that way. If it's super like fashion-y, if it's super model-esque, not realistic in a way, I feel like it can be scrolled through quick. So I felt like the relating aspect is something that people would like, grabbing attention, quick, easy to read. And that creative passed, and then I completely just understood Facebook ads after. I was like, whoa, okay, now I understand Facebook ads.
Yeah.
Getting into details, was a little bit challenging afterwards, mm-hmm. but yeah, that was very general.
One question I had for you is, you spoke about having a converting website, right? So mm-hmm. let's go into the details of a converting website. I've tried Facebook ads before, and your website can look beautiful. It can have the best design ever, and it doesn't convert, even though everything is well organized. What makes a great converting website?
I think what makes a great converting website is having quick and clear vision and clarity to the audience reading of what your product does and what the benefits are. So for example, you're leading them to a homepage and you want them to get hooked. Every website should get you hooked into, let's say, I'm just talking product-based because my business is product-based, but let's say you're talking to a product website. You're looking at a product website. You want to, as you scroll through, leading them to a homepage and getting them hooked through that. First of all, describing what the benefits are, showing them credibility that there's reviews, showing them a video, showing them imagery, showing them. So first of all, I believe that the clearer it is, more simple it is, very quick and easy to read it is, and aesthetically pleasing, then it would convert better. The first thing to check is to have a converting product. If you are 100% sure product is converting, then there's something with your website if the website's not converting. It could also be something with the price. So sometimes a converting website could look like giving a price discount or just understanding the price that you're pricing the product at. Are there a lot of competitors that are pricing it way lower than you? Is that something that people can get easily other places? And then looking at that and getting real with the product itself. And I think if the product doesn't convert, the website cannot convert. And that's the first thing to look at before looking at just the website. So aesthetically pleasing websites that don't explain the product, that don't show the product being used, have a harder time converting. Because if the product, some people, for example, if you're selling earrings, having earrings just on a table looking aesthetically pleasing may not sell the earrings because you don't have them on a model or someone who can show. Yeah, like if I'm buying earrings, I wouldn't know how they're going to look like on someone. So having it displayed on someone using it would convert better.
Got it.
As a general concept, yeah.
Most definitely. That was a big gem. Thank you. So now you craft your website up, you edit it and get it right. Now and then you go back into the ads now, right? What changes did you make to get the ads right?
So first of all, looking at the data of the ad. So let's say we have an ad, and before we decide what the ad is doing, we have to look at the data. Looking at the click-through rate, first of all, looking at the clicks. Are there enough clicks? And are people clicking but not buying, or are people not clicking? So if people are not clicking, there's just very little clicks, then that means the ad itself is not converting, or it's not converting into clicks. So people are not interested enough in that advertisement. If people are clicking but then not buying, then your website could be the one that's not converting, or your product, and that's where you kind of look at both of them. So changing things depending on what is happening to the advertising is always important, because changing something without knowing the data will be hard because you don't know what to change. So I believe I had to change a lot of things in my advertising here and there. What I noticed is that comments, look at what people are saying. First of all, looking at what people are saying is really important, because the customers are the backbone of the business. The customers are what we're serving. And if you're not serving the customers, then you're serving no one. Your business will eventually die, unless you're just serving yourself and that's just a personal, I don't know, hobby. But so a business has to have customers, and those customers will give you feedback, especially on the advertising. And if people are commenting, saying something, giving you feedback, always listening is really important. Sometimes there's comments that are crazy, so just deleting those or not replying to them is fine, but always listening. For example, if a customer has a problem with the way you worded something, or where you showed something, or has confusion about the product. So when they're asking something, so what I did, I edited my ad many times because customers were asking about something. For example, oh, does this grip when you sweat? Does this do this? And some customers were asking all these questions, and I decided, okay, well, we're going to change the ad, add that information, because a lot of people are wondering. Some people don't actually comment in that advertisement to tell you that. So it's not just one person that commented. It's actually probably 100 that wondered that and scrolled through and didn't get that answer. So putting that back in the video is something that is always important. I think that's the main thing.
Listen, the more subscribers we have, the better the guests get. So please hit subscribe. Let's get back into the show.
In copywriting for a long, long time, I came up, I started this idea called conversion copywriting, which is the idea that your copy is supposed to move people to yes. So growth marketing, we talk about growth marketing, is growth separate from marketing, except whatever. So fine. But point is that your copy, when you're writing something on the page, it should be moving people to take the action that you want them to take. And that ideally, if they're there looking at it, they probably want to take too. So we teach people based on what we learn when we test with clients. We teach people, and by people I really do mean startup founders, marketers at tech companies largely, and copywriters, how to write copy that gets people to say yes. And we do that over at copyhackers.com. Was that a minute? That was like 23 seconds.
Nah, you bodied it.
For sure. What are the elements that go into making good copy, like foundational pieces?
So I would say the most foundational are one. So we think back to list, offer, copy, which is an old but constant idea. The list being the visitors, the people who are supposed to be, who you're targeting, who you wish would say yes to this offer, and who probably should say yes to this offer. So not, oh, everybody in this persona group, but like who are you targeting with this one thing? That's list. Then comes offer, then comes copy. So let's say you've got your list sorted out, you know who the visitor is, you know who the subscriber is, etc. Then comes offer, what's the right offer for them? And that's typically dependent on who they are and what stage of awareness they are at. So you know those things, figure out list, figure out stage of awareness for that list, match the right offer to them, making it sound good. So free trial is not an offer. And then get into copy. And copy, the stuff that goes on the page, there's a lot too, but I would say if you had to whittle it down to its core elements, the things that can help make your copy better, start with the persuasion framework. So that means if you got a blank page, type the word problem, then hit enter a bunch of times, then agitation, then hit enter a bunch of times, and then solution, and then hit enter a bunch of times, and then go fill that in with voice of customer data, which is like, listen to people talking about your product, about your competitor's product, about product in the category that you're in, lots of things. Go listen objectively. When they say something interesting or they say something really frequently, you keep hearing multiple people saying it, take that word for word, pop it under problem or agitation or solution. And then from there, you can go in and clean it up, make it quote unquote sound good, and use formulas to really make your headlines, your buttons, everything inside your body copy pop. Once you've done that, you've got a first draft in place. That's copywriting. Those are the elements. You got to have frameworks. You got to have voice of customer data. And then you've got to go over it with formulas to make it work better.
This podcast is brought to you by Nyorai Cellars. If you didn't know, Nyorai Cellars is the only Black-owned wine company in Canada. Right now, I'm holding the Rosé, the 2021 Rosé bottle. This drink is amazing. I mean, it's perfect for those dishes such as seafood where you're cooking shrimp, you're having some pasta, whatever it is you're having, grab a bottle of Nyorai Cellars, the Rosé. If you're having a date night with your significant other, you know what to grab. Grab the Nyorai. Whatever it is, grab the Nyorai. I mean, you will not go wrong with this wine. It's perfect for everybody. If you've never drank wine, this is a great bottle for you. Or even if you're a wine expert, you're an aficionado and you drink everything. I mean, you cannot go in Nyorai. I'm telling you, this wine is really, really good. And even though I'm boosting it this hard, it's because I really love drinking it and I'm someone who loves to drink wine. So whatever it is, whatever the special occasion, check out Nyorai. They have Sauvignon Blancs, they have Rieslings. I'm holding the Rosé right now. They have a wide variety of different collections of different wines you can choose from. Make sure to check them out. The link is going to be in the description. Check them out. Order a crate for yourself, or you can send a gift to someone that you want to gift some wine to. You can't go wrong with that. So Nyorai Cellars, check them out. Link will be in the description. And now back to the show.
And is this like also for, let's say, product descriptions? Like, is this a framework you're using for everything to make good copy? Or is it just like maybe like a about us page or like what the product does? Like,
walk us through. Yeah, I think if you want people to take action on it, then you should work on it. I think you owe it to your prospect to work on it. And by the way, once you do, copy is your scalable salesperson. Like, once you've done it, you have now trained an army of salespeople, but it's just like one little block of copy that works all the time everywhere because you worked so hard on it and got it right. So yeah, there's the framework for the page. Let's say it's problem, agitation, solution, or attention, interest, desire, action. There's lots of frameworks out there that you can use. Then you're going to write within those things, right? So within each section, you're going to have like, let's say body copy. So you'll want to have a framework to make that body copy pop as well. So let's say you're in the desire, or let's go back to problem agitation solution. You're in the solution part. You're talking about your solution on this page. Okay. You're in the body copy for one of your features. That alone, when you think about like, okay, how do I write that section? Most people have no flipping clue and they just like write down whatever and it sucks. But you're like, it's okay, nobody reads online anyway, which we love telling ourselves. Not true at all. So that's the part where you want to use a framework again. So in there, you could use attention, interest, desire, action, or you could use something like problem, cure, proof, offer. There's lots of frameworks all over the place, but use them not because, oh no, Joe's added a layer of hard work, but because facing the blank page is super tough. It will destroy you the more you have to do it. But if you have those frameworks, those tell you, hey, here's a proven way, proven over time by just countless copywriters. And that's why these frameworks exist and are like publicly known today. You don't have to guess anymore. Now you can just like take out all of that hard work that used to keep you from writing copy that actually gets people to say yes. You used to write copy that like just sounded good and that was it. And then, you know, you convert 1 or 2%. But when we're talking about actually moving people like en masse to do something, yeah, use a framework at every level and use a formula further down. So if you're writing a crosshead or a subhead or a button, all of this can be made better and done faster by using a formula or a framework, depending on the job.
Big gems. Like that was like a bomb drop. Now, one thing you kind of walked through, and I think it might have gone over people's heads, was the IDA model: attention, interest, desire, action. You know, yeah. I want to have that in people's minds just so they can have that as a, you know, a cookie, a little takeaway that they can put in their back pocket and keep with them as they go into their marketing worlds as entrepreneurs. So that's attention, interest, desire, action. Could you break down real quick why that's the model?
That's one framework to use. Yeah. Oh, for sure. Yeah, exactly. So, so attention is where you capture their attention, of course, right? So that can be a good hook. You can open a curiosity gap. It might be something about things that are universally interesting to people, making money, saving money, getting a partner, finding happiness, saving time. Those are like often like good attention grabbers. So how can I grab your attention? And I know it's easy, just like any tool, you can use it wrong and really like obviously if you're not selling Tab's chocolate, like go easy on the attention with sex thing. Okay. Like there's other ways to grab people's attention, but get their attention. And then you want to build on that. So once you've like captured their attention with a good headline, good subject line, let's say in email, a headline in ads, or like an image with a good little line of copy on it in like a TikTok ad you might put together or something, then you want to build on that. So how do you convert their attention into now real interest? So I might have heard how you made $600,000 doing X. Now, but my skepticism kicks in, couldn't possibly be right for me, etc. And that's where you build the interest for me. Like, okay, it can work for you. Here's how it worked for others. And then you turn that interest. Okay, now I'm interested. This could actually work for me. But now what's keeping me away from that is I don't actually see how that will fit in my life. Once you can show me that and build that desire, which is the goal of marketing overall, is to grab attention, turn it into interest, and then get that desire just like amped right up. Once you get that desire in place, desire for how it will live in my life, desire for the outcomes that I can expect to have, then you got to close the deal. And that's where action comes in. And that's not as simple as putting a call to action in there. Yes, a call to action exists in this part of your copy, but it's really about, this is the part where you overcome those like last minute anxieties that are keeping me from saying yes, money back guarantees. So I might order this Tab's chocolate. Does it work for my partner? Or is it just for the woman in the relationship? Answer these questions if you haven't already, like the closers. What do I really need to know to hit order on this now? Offer optimization is what comes into play here. So when we were thinking about list offer copy, offer that you are working on gets, you know, pushed down and really amplified in the action section. So I know you've got my attention, piqued my interest, and now I desire this in my life. Close me. Don't, this is a really important part. And if you work on it, it actually pays off. Like copy is such a measurable thing. So if you work on that action part of it, Then you can really close actual sales instead of just having a shop now button. What else do you need around that? How else can you get people to click the button? And sometimes, and there's so many different things we could talk about to get people to do this, but it's important to start by just thinking about it and making sure that you're covering your bases with attention, interest, desire, action, or whatever framework you decide to use.
Why people wear your t-shirts is because the way it makes them feel, or anything, why they use any products, it's because it's the way it makes them feel. If they buy, I mean, for a few reasons, like if I were to buy some organic, you know, hair gel or something, part of that is, yeah, it makes me, you know, it's like I'm using organic hair gel, but a lot of it is, you know, too, I want to feel like as a person that I'm doing, you know, I'm doing my body well. I'm using organic this and organic that. I eat organic. It's like, how do I feel as a person overall when I do that? You know, when I wear a certain shirt, when you wear the shirts that promote your own clothing or your own brand and your own company, it makes you feel a certain way, like makes you feel like, hey, I'm working. You know, it's like, this is what I stand for. When people see you and ask you, what's that shirt about? You get to explain it, you know, and it makes you feel a certain way when you put that shirt on. And that's kind of how Tap Out was. We knew that because we'd put this shirt on so many big fighters in the UFC, I mean, you got to remember early on, because we were training in the sport and the sport was really small, if you look at those early UFCs, we had guys fighting wearing our clothing because they were guys that we trained with or guys that we knew, a guy who knew somebody who was training with that guy. So we could get to those guys. So they were all wearing Tap Out shirts. And so when people were into the sport, they would want to wear a shirt because they wanted to be like those guys. Those guys got to fight in the UFC. They were tough dudes, big guys. When they put that shirt on, they felt like those guys. Like a suit, like they felt like Superman for a minute. You know what I mean? And so people want, it's a feeling. I mean, you got to remember this t-shirt, this is a plain t-shirt, right? There's nothing on this shirt. This shirt cost me, I got a pack of them for $15 or something. Three of them for $15. They're $5 each. Why will I buy the, you know, why don't people just buy this shirt? Why are they going to pay $25 for a shirt rather than $5? The only reason why is because it's the way that shirt makes it.
I don't know if we haven't had Rihanna, but I definitely sent her some stuff. So shout out to Rihanna. If she,
how do you get Rihanna's contact? How'd that work?
So honestly, I realized that like the biggest thing with celebrities, it's either like a stylist. Usually if they're like a really big celebrity, it's really about like a stylist. The stylist is the one that's kind of working with the celebrity on a daily basis. Some stylists are more involved. Like some stylists, they'll like literally pick the outfit for you, or not pick it, but they'll like create the look for the client. They'll give head to toe look. They'll be like, okay, this is what I'm thinking, blah blah blah. And if the artist trusts the stylist, it's a go. Some other stylists, they work with the client as well, but it's less dressy. They'll give the client options. They'll be like, okay, you know, like I got the new blah, blah, blah. It's in your closet, you know, and then the artists will just throw it on themselves. But as a stylist, it's really about filtering things through and trying to get like things that kind of, you know, represent or make your client look the best. So as a stylist, you're always looking for new designers, always looking for new brands, because that also means that everyone else isn't wearing it. So if I'm a stylist, I'm not going to, obviously, everyone's gonna wear like the bigger brands, but if you can get like a younger designer, a kid that hasn't really been like exposed to the world yet, not only are you helping out that that younger designer and helping him like develop his brand and helping him get exposure, but you're also kind of creating this kind of like exclusivity with your client, where it's like, hey, I found this like younger designer from like Austria or Toronto. And you know, it's really sick, but no one's really on it.
Growing the service providers, now you need to focus on the actual users. I think that's a lot tougher, because a lot of times people who create these apps are the people who are in the service provider section, like you were. But getting the users though is a lot tougher. Like, walk us through how you created a good user base.
Yeah, to your point, let's say you had a barbershop and you had four chairs in there. Would you rather have a line of 100 people outside wanting their haircut, or would you rather have like too many barbers? You know, obviously you will really would rather have a line of people around the block. Mm-hmm. So that's the harder part of the transaction in most cases, in most marketplaces, definitely is for ours. We knew we could get supply on board if so long we could get demand. Mm-hmm. And so that's where focus came into play again. You know, we focus just on Nashville and we try to figure out, okay, how can we get 100 people a week to sign up for a lawn mowing service in Nashville? And we would try everything. We, like I said, we tried door hangers. We tried Facebook ads, Google ads, Pinterest ads, Instagram ads. We tried everything. We just could not get anything to like break loose. And then the only thing that really started clicking for us was organic search. People searching for lawn mowing service nearby me, lawn mowing service Nashville, Tennessee, lawn mowing service East Nashville, Tennessee. And we really started trying to build out content and compete for these types of search queries. And there again, we started to learn really quick early on, wow, this is really, 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 really hard. Like competing with the Thumbtacks of the world and the Angie's List and Home Advisors of the world. It was really, really hard because our domain didn't have the authority. And we started understanding, wow, if we're going to really try to make search our main acquisition channel, it's a bet the company decision. And that was a decision we made early on, just out of lack of options. We knew, okay, well, we're just going to bet the company on search and we're going to throw everything we can into it. And so if you do that, you need to know that like half of whatever it is you're doing is building the product, satisfying users, laying out like the feature set and like executing a product roadmap. But then like the other entire half of what you're doing is working on SEO. It's a core competency of the company in terms of creating the content, building the platform to be congruent with what Google wants, and then doing the outreach around getting backlinks and PR and all that. It's just like my co-founder to this day, all he does is PR. And he's doing PR just to keep our name in the lights, but also for our SEO strategy. And so it's a lot of work, but it's one that you can accumulate equity in, and it's one that makes it makes your business a little bit more durable. And so here we are 8 years in, you know, we do really well off SEO. In fact, that's still how we get half of our users. The other half just come through word of mouth. We still don't do any paid marketing.
Interesting. Hold on. So it's all organic SEO,
all
not just
organic. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Because here's the thing. If you're going to try to compete in paid channels, a lot of times, you know, paid channels are great as a complementary channel in terms of like, okay, I'm already doing well. Now I want to do like 10 or 20% better. I'm going to start paying for traffic. But it's really hard to like, it's really, really, really difficult to make the economics work in any business, not even just a marketplace, but any business. It's really hard to make the economics work to where you can just buy traffic and that just carry you all the way through. You rarely see that happen. And a lot of times this is what happens. It's like Uber for X, Uber for laundry service, Uber for home cleaners. They raise $20 million. They give it all right back to Google. And then they don't have a business. They can't raise another 50. So it's lights out. And it's a sad story. Everybody lost their money. And those entrepreneurs wasted 4 years of their life.
Speaking of shelves, how can entrepreneurs get premium shelf space in a fridge?
Boy, you're asking some tough questions, man. I think that getting premium shelf space is very challenging, right? I think that, again, you know, when you go into the big leagues, you have to play with the big boys. So, you know, that comes with a lot of financial strain as well, and being able to pay sometimes for shelf space. So in certain instances, we've been, you know, lucky enough to be a local company and that sort of thing, and, you know, given access to shelf space. But when you want to pay for, let's what they call like end caps and that sort of thing, where, you know, you're seeing the product at the end of the, before you get down the aisle, that's really premium. Mm-hmm. So so sometimes you have to pay for that. You know, like ourselves, if you go into Loblaw's chain store, you can get optimum points, right? You've got to pay for all of those things too, right? So it takes a while in terms of scaling and, you know, all of that sort of thing.
So
you just said, what was that? You said you have to pay for optimum points? Of course.
Whoa, I didn't
know
that.
We never know. Yeah.
Hold on.
I thought Optimum Points just like scan my thing, I get points, I'm done.
No, so, man. As retailers.
Really?
As a retailer, hopefully Optimum, you know, isn't listening to this. But, I mean, that's the model. I mean, funny enough, before getting full-time into Sweet and Nice, I mean, my background was loyalty.
Loyalty, right?
Right? Yeah. So basically, yeah, as a retailer, yeah, as a vendor, you pay for access to Optimum.
That's how they make money.
Mm-hmm. But I mean, it's a great, that's how they make money. But again, from a consumer perspective, you got to look at it in terms of, hey, you know, like my wife, she dies for Optimum Points. Oh, I've got like 10,000 Optimum Points and I'm spending it.
I was eyeing a cologne. I'm like, when I get to 50K, I'm buying that Giorgio Armani cologne.
So there you go, right? Yeah. There's something behind loyalty that drives people. So you got to be thinking about, all of those things in terms of like, you know, paying for flyers, whether it was back then, physical, digital, you know, all of those things you got to think about, right? So because, you know, you don't want to be sitting on the shelf and then your competitor next to you is on sale and you're not on sale and all that sort of thing. I mean, the other challenge that you have as well is that entrepreneurs need to think about is distribution. Because, you know, if you want to be probably kind of call us a pseudo national brand, right? Because you could go to, you know, BC and get us or Quebec and get us and that sort of thing. But how do you get the stuff from here to there, right? You need to have a good distributor or a couple of good distributors to do that. And that costs because, of course, that eats into your margin as well. So all of those things you got to think about in terms of like scaling.
All right, so it brings me to two questions. One, how do you find a distributor that's quality? Or are all distributors made the same? Or once you get into... No. All right, so let's walk through that. Then after, I want to ask, like, what's the average? You don't have to give yours, of course, but what's the average profit margin of ice cream or food in general? I'd love to have that conversation right after. So let's talk distributors.
Yeah, with distributors, it's funny enough. I heard somebody say it the other day. It's like a marriage, basically. You got to find a good one, just like a co-packer as well. It's a marriage in terms of who is able to do your product, do it well, you're comfortable with. They can see that you're going to grow and all that sort of thing. So it's the same thing with a distributor. I think when we first started off, you're looking at the distributor, right? Mm-hmm. In terms of, you know, me delivering stuff to stores
and all of that sort of thing, right? Your grandfather.
So I was doing all of that. Me and my aunt did some of it as well and all of that sort of thing, cousin and that sort of thing too. So, and then eventually we started like, you know, paying someone to do it and that sort of thing. But then when you're starting to think about like, hey, we need to get the product to Alberta or here or there. So then you got to look for a really good distributor who would fit into your margin profile as you grow. There's always challenges around that in terms of like managing that too. But then you need to find someone who literally, again, it's all about relationships, believing in you, believing that you would grow. The distributor that we're with right now, we started off with them maybe about 4 years ago. And we were a lot smaller, and I would say they took a chance on us. And now we're a lot bigger, right? So basically they've seen the benefits of that in terms of us, you know, starting off with Sobeys. Then we went to Loblaws, and now, you know, growing in terms of like with Metro and a couple of other people too, right? So it's key in terms of finding someone who, you know, and again, you know, to the entrepreneurs out there, you may need to switch up your distributors as well, because you may start with someone, you know, locally, right, who just does GTA and they've got a good margin profile. Then you're expanding, then you do that as well. So yeah, that's how we do it.
Would you ever go D2C? Would you ever go D2C? Direct to consumer?
Yes, we have done a bit of that online.
Your own store, right?
Yeah, we have done a bit of that online and then retail store as well.
How did that go? Because I don't know, it must be a lot more difficult with ice cream. Right.
Online stuff is completely difficult here in terms of doing that. It's much bigger in the States, but over here it's definitely still a challenge, although during the pandemic it got a bit easier to do that sort of thing. At the beginning of the pandemic, again, we didn't have any demos, so we did a pop-up store, which worked really well in terms of getting people to come to us, try the ice cream, and then go back into retail. So, so that's probably something we'd look at later on down the line as well in terms of, you know, having direct-to-consumer sales too.
Speaking about the pandemic, we were interviewing Steve Byfield of Nyarai Cellars. Are you familiar with that wine? He's like one of the only black wine sellers.
Yeah, I've heard about him, yeah.
Yeah. Did you see any boost in business by you being like an ice cream brand that's black owned during the pandemic, getting buzz, press, and how did that really impact your business in terms of like sales?
Yeah, I think 2020, you know, with everyone being stuck at home and that sort of thing, yeah, we did see definitely increase in sales. The beginning of the year was terrible because then, you know, no one knew what was going on.
Exactly.
We had signed up to go into both No Frills and Metro. Didn't go into those stores until the end of July, right? So like the end of the summer, basically. Yeah. But it still worked out pretty well. And we you know, again, for entrepreneurs out there, we had to like, you know, get like a PR firm and, you know, all of that sort of thing as well on board. So basically we combined with the retail store, we did a lot of PR. And again, being black owned, we were picked up by a lot of media as well. So it did help in terms of brand awareness, for sure.
Most definitely. Now, speaking of brand awareness, we would be dum-dums if we didn't talk about this. Dragon's Den.
Yes.
Oh, right.
You know what I'm saying? Yes. Let's talk about the experience on Dragon's Den. Because a lot of us entrepreneurs, especially Canadian entrepreneurs, are like, should I go on Dragon's Den? You know, all that kind of stuff, right? So what was your Dragon's Den experience like?
It was great, actually. It was pretty good. I mean, I always use the word petrifying in the same sentence too, because it was. You know, when my cousin Stefan and myself decided to go on it, and we thought, hey, it's gonna be, you know, I love the show, so we thought, hey, let's go on it, see what would happen, see if we would get in, number one. Because you got to go through, like, you know, filters of producers and that sort of thing. And, you know, when we spoke to the producers, they loved it. They loved the idea. They loved the story. They actually, you know, I can't remember whether we flipped a coin to ride in the bike or whatever. But basically, you know, it was pretty good. And then when we went in, I mean, I would say we were lucky to be the first company in the morning time on the show in terms of going in to speak to dragons. So that helped as well. They were all perky and happy.
They're
and
fresh.
All that, you know,
they just exactly had their Starbucks.
Coffee up and all that sort of thing.
Ready,
and then, of course,
check.
Then we're talking ice cream. So what could be wrong with that,
yes,
right? So we went in and, yeah, it was tough in terms of the questions that they were asking. We were still young in terms of only in independent stores, right? And probably in about 40 stores, not much revenue, that sort of thing, doing a lot of the revenue over the summertime. So we spoke a lot about how we were going to talk about that and address some of those questions and that sort of thing. So, but it was a good experience. And then, you know, on the show, we got a deal on the show. Didn't work out in the end after the show because you got to go through a whole mad load of due diligence and all that good stuff. Mm. But yeah, it did well in terms of raising our brand and people still remember us today. And yeah, we're on Netflix.
You can say, you can catch you on Netflix.
You can like turn in yourself and just look at yourself on Netflix sometimes.
Yeah.
That's fire.